Tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. So yesterday at tea time, we were having a Dhamma discussion, and I was pointing out a set of teachings that the Buddha gave that I couldn't remember exactly. Question was around just in picking up a particular theme of, I'll say, like asubha gamatan, or the contemplation of the body, and then starting to feel kind of oppressed by that, and then so what to do. And it brought to mind a set of teachings in my recollection that where the Buddha gave four particular teachings, asubha gamatan, marana sati, and then metta bhavana, and buddhanu sati, recollection of the Buddha. And these are practices that one can use to balance the mind. And this is something that is, you know, I think, quite typical of how the Buddha taught and instructed, in that sense of trying to give the tools by which we can create a sense of balance, of wholeness, of completion, recognizing that at different times the mind needs different things, different motivations, different reflection, different moods even. So that certainly the themes of the unattractive nature of the body, contemplations of death, these are very sobering. They tend to bring up a sense of urgency. And then the themes of loving kindness and the recollections of the Buddha are things that bring up a sense of brightness, happiness, confidence, faith. They have a different kind of feel to them. But today I spent about, close to an hour trying to find that set of teachings, and for the life of me I couldn't find it. So I'm not 100% sure that I got it right, and I can't remember what the name of it is, so I'm actually throwing it out to people to maybe comb your memory banks and see if you can remember that. Because it is a helpful set of teachings for kind of the nuts and bolts of practice. And you find that the Buddha gives these fundamental teachings, or teachings that help one lay the foundations of practice and lay a good kind of a balance within the practice. You know, think of another set of teachings like that, where the Buddha speaks of these four Dhamma principles that are primal, that are unadulterated, that are relied upon by the wise, that are ancient, and not to be refuted or denigrated by any other wanderers of other sects. Even is the Buddha saying, these Dhamma principles would be upheld by any type of practitioner who was seeking peace, seeking truth. And the first is non-longing, second is loving kindness, third is right mindfulness, and the fourth is right concentration. And so those are, I think, another set of useful teachings to ground oneself in practices that help one to really lay a solid foundation in the fundamentals of one's practice, so that to look to that quality of non-longing, because the sense of desire, longing, kind of imagining something better. What was it? There was a bumper sticker that was like sort of me happy, somewhere else, some other time. that longing, sort of. But it's always putting that kind of happiness, contentment, well-being somewhere else, and then it perpetuates that quality of longing. And there is a certain, how do you say, there is a certain attachment that we have to longing. And because on a certain level, you know, what would we do if we actually got what we wanted? What would we do if we really were able to come to the end of desire and attachment? And, you know, Ajahn Chah used to tease us about that. He said, you know, you know, what would you do if you actually didn't have any desires and attachments? You wouldn't have any friends, would you? You know, you wouldn't know what to do with yourself. So it was, we're so used to that model of how the mind works, and so that it's really important to contemplate just that quality of non-longing. How can we actually live like that? How can we live in a way, and also, you know, obviously make ourselves useful bring benefit to ourselves and to others? Because that's a quality that the Buddha emphasizes over and over again, that you say this practice of Dhamma is for our own benefit and for the benefit of others. It isn't an annihilation. It isn't a negation. And it isn't an isolation from anything. So that one has to contemplate, what would it be like to relinquish that sense of longing and desire and attachment and that fascination with something other than what we're experiencing? You know, what would it be like to be content, to really be content? And so that we have to encourage ourselves in different ways and to reflect on it. Now, and that's where the contemplation of, say, of dukkha, contemplation of that suffering, dissatisfaction, discontent, that's the first noble truth. To see the danger in that, the repetitive cycles that keep bringing us back to that sense of stress, suffering, dissatisfaction. And it's through seeing that clearly that, of course, that we're willing to relinquish, and seeing the burden that it places on the mind to always be, you know, proliferating about the next thing. The next thing we'll get consumed, we become. So that the contemplation of non-longing, there's a coolness and a brightness that can arise when we really contemplate it deeply. And then contemplating and working with the quality of metta, of loving kindness, of goodwill, where we're able to relinquish aversion, ill will, negativity, again, because it's painful. And it's a burden on the heart, and allow the mind to dwell in and to fill itself with this quality of metta, of goodwill, where one wishes the best for oneself and wishes others well, has that sense of well-wishing, that wish for others' happiness and one's own happiness. And a kind of a true happiness rather than a fleeting gratification. So that establishing that wish within the heart. And when we do that, of course, it highlights and emphasizes it becomes much more clear when we do have kind of irritation, ill will, aversion, negativity, and one can see more clearly how obstructive that is to the heart that's really spacious and expansive, abundant. So that's something that we can be doing as a practice. that developing of goodwill, and say one doesn't have to wait for aversion and negativity to arise before countering it with goodwill and with loving kindness. Being proactive in the raising of that quality up into the heart, because quite naturally it lends itself to states of happiness. There's a happiness and well-being that arises within the heart. And that's really helpful for practice, in the sense that when there's that quality of well-being, there tend to be more energy for practice, because negativity and ill will, it sucks energy out of the mind, out of the heart. It darkens the mind. It clouds it. So that being proactive in lifting that quality up, establishing it, seeing the benefit in it, gaining confidence in it as a suitable foundation for the heart. Right, mindfulness. Mindfulness is sometimes just sort of talked about on its own. But the Buddha is really emphasizing the need for right mindfulness, appropriate, proper mindfulness. I was like, I remember Ajahn Chah, so he said, well, you have to establish right mindfulness, because I mean, even a cat is mindful. It wouldn't be able to catch mice if it wasn't mindful. But we have to have some kind of mindfulness that is humanized, that uplifts the mind. Or a thief has to be mindful. They're not mindful and attentive. They'll never be able to steal. It's like a pickpocket or a thief of some sort has to, by the very nature of what they're doing, have to be very mindful. But that doesn't mean that it's good. And it doesn't mean it's useful. It doesn't mean it's beneficial for anybody. So that this quality of right mindfulness is a important factor in our cultivation, in that as we cultivate mindfulness, there's a reflective quality to the mindfulness. There's a investigative quality that's there, and it's like in the Thai language, when the teachers speak about practice, there's a word that's used over and over and over again. And it's a compound word, satipanya, just using as the words mindfulness and wisdom. But it has a quality of amplifying its function, so that one of the translations that I really like of that phrase is truth-discerning awareness. So that when we have that truth-discerning awareness, there's both that presence of mind, but then there's an attentiveness to truth, getting things in their proper perspective. So that mindfulness is, and particularly right mindfulness, is a quality that the Buddha lifts up and praises. And I think of the set of teachings that the Buddha gave that are called the seven factors of enlightenment. And three of them are kind of active qualities, in the sense of investigation of Dhamma, effort, joy. And three of them are kind of settling qualities, tranquility, concentration, equanimity. And then the other factor is mindfulness. And when the Buddha explains it in that way, he emphasizes that mindfulness is good at any time, in the sense that sometimes one needs to bring up more active qualities, sometimes one needs to bring more settling qualities, but you always have to be bringing in mindfulness. You always have to be applying that mindfulness, that truth-discerning awareness, in order for the practice to really, really flourish. The last quality being right concentration, samadhi. And samadhi is sometimes I don't really like using the word concentration, or like in terms of that for samadhi, but it's what's commonly used. And I kind of like the Thai translation. It's a bit long, the firm establishing of the mind, and maybe that samadhi as a settling quality, a firm quality of mind, stability of mind. And that stability doesn't come about through just forcing the mind to be still, or forcing the mind to stop thinking, forcing the mind to shut up. It's when the mind actually comes together and integrates, that obstacles drop away and the mind becomes more still and clear. And it's that stability and clarity that allows us to have deeper insights into the nature of the mind, into the working of the mind, into the nature of kind of the human condition, the workings of the human condition, and the way out. So that as the mind becomes more steady and still, it's an essential tool for our growth in practice. Sometimes people will sort of, they'll quote Ajahn Chah as well, sort of say, well, Ajahn Chah says, you just have to be mindful in all the things that you do, and that's enough. And sometimes he does say that. But one shouldn't disregard that settling of the mind, the importance of samadhi, the stillness of mind, because there's most of us have difficulty in settling the mind and bringing the mind to a place of real stillness and silence. Ajahn Lee Damodaro said there's he said it's like building a bridge over a river or a stream. Putting in the pillars on this side of the stream and that side of the stream are the easier part to build of the bridge. It's putting those pillars in the middle part of the stream where the current is stronger. That's more difficult. And he said it's like that in that, because usually the path of the Buddha's teaching is summarized as sila, samadhi, panya, virtue, meditation, wisdom. And it's that middle part of the samadhi that tends to be more difficult. But just because it's more difficult doesn't mean we try to find ways to get out of it. As long as we haven't put those pillars in, got that bridge across, then the path is still incomplete. So that learning how to look after the mind, encourage the mind, uplift the heart so that there's a settling that takes place, and working with the different factors of the meditation that help the mind to integrate, help the mind to come together. So that those aspects of certainly the application of mindfulness, but also mindfulness has to be supported by, say, by faith, confidence in oneself, confidence in the teaching, confidence in the path of practice. There needs to be an effort, a consistency of effort, a willingness to be to be diligent in the training, and there needs to be that discernment, investigation, contemplation, so that there's settling aspects happening, but there's also that application of the discursive elements of the mind, that bringing things up for contemplation, bringing things up for reflection, learning how to analyze and see clearly. What's the nature of this particular obstacle? What's the nature of the tools that I have at hand? What are the ways that I can support and encourage the mind. It's using that discernment, using investigation, so that as we do that, then there is a because the stillness of mind or settling of the mind, that firm establishing of the mind, it isn't through making or forcing or trying to get the mind to become peaceful. It's around, so much of it is around being willing to relinquish and let go, learning how to put down, release the obstacles and obsessions that the mind keeps grabbing onto. And then there's a natural settling that takes place. And of course that settling and that clarity is where our insights arise. That seeing through the word vipassana, and it's usually used, the insight is literally would be seeing through. So seeing through phenomena, seeing through the nature of things, seeing through the delusions that we carry, and coming to a place of true knowledge. So that these are what the Buddha calls primal, they're ancient. These are Dhamma principles that we need to rely on. They've been used and tested and applied for a long time, and those principles will continue to be relevant and useful as long as human beings have minds. These are the useful qualities to be bringing into being and learning how to apply skillfully. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.